Elizabeth Esty, I guess I want to talk to you today about LGBT rights in light of the shooting. There have been a lot of analysis as to why he walked into this place and shot everybody up and killed 49 people. One of them is that he himself may have harbored some gay tendencies and was taking it out on others because of his own fearfulness about himself. But then there were all those who say that he took his orders from across the waters, even though he was so-called self-radicalized, except that the people who were calling for all of this were saying, go shoot people. So I don't know how you're self-radicalized if you're listening to the people over there. Maybe you don't get a paycheck, but okay, I've talked too much. What do you think?
Well, I think clearly the picture is pretty complicated. We're learning things every hour now about his background, which, you know, makes it again more difficult to understand exactly what happens. And let's be clear, at least for myself, I can say I don't really understand how any human being can decide to take the life of dozens of people, mow them down, shoot them in a nightclub, in a school, on a street, in a church. That defies my ability to understand what motivates any human being to do that. I think we do get some sense of, in his case, alienation, of not feeling included. I mean, that's what he told the FBI as part of the interviews when they were considering putting him on and briefly had him on the terror watch list. But I think what we can identify clearly is we've made all these strides. We've made so much progress on LGBT rights in this country, on really, and we've got more work to do. I'm not saying we're done, but we've made so much progress in allowing the human potential of every American to be who he or she truly and fully is. And I think we want to continue to stand up strongly and proudly in the world for that. And the U.S. is seen as a real bright spot in the world of freedom and of individual dignity. And it's clear that for radical ideologies, that's threatening. That kind of individual freedom is threatening to some people and some ideologies. And so it doesn't surprise me that you would see targeting. It's very sad and it's shameful, but it's not entirely surprising.
I know you've mentioned that your brother, you have a gay brother. What are you hearing about the way in which gays are treated and as a result of this? What are you hearing from the gay community as a representative?
Well, we had a joint Muslim community and Gay Pride vigil in Hartford on Sunday evening, and folks I've worked with over the years in both communities, you know, standing proudly together and saying, you know, we as Americans don't support the kind of hate that we saw in Orlando, that we stand united in respect for human beings and respect for human life and respect for human dignity. And I really do believe, Alan, that, you know, one of the best cures for hatred is love. And I know that sounds ridiculous on some levels, but truly having empathy and understanding others leads to a reduction of fear. And so much of the hatred we see, I think, comes from fear. I think it comes from fear, and I think we're going to see that with this attack or two, that it was fear and perhaps even fear of himself and his own nature that he was in conflict about. I think it's too early to say that, but I think we want to continue to be a country that cherishes and supports individuals and encourages them to be their true selves.
If Donald Trump is elected president of the United States, he could be, you know. I mean, he's got a lot of people out there who are for him. We don't hear much from them, but the polls are showing some very close races, although Hillary seems to be pulling ahead a little bit now. What would you expect would happen to this country?
I don't know. I try not to contemplate that too much. I feel like the most important thing I can do, in a lot of ways, Alan, is to try to lead by example in the tone of voice, the inclusiveness of how I deal with people, to try to bring people together to solve the problems we've got in this country and in this world. I think we do that better by being united, by being collaborative, by being respectful with each other. And again, we've got to find ways to respectfully disagree. That, you know, civil disagreement is core to this country, and it's gotten so incredibly uncivil, in fact, hateful, divisive right now, that I am concerned.
I want to hone in on that, and I want to let you off the hook. You said what you would do.
What do we do as a country? What does a country look like?
What does a country do if he gets elected?
I've got to believe that American democracy is resilient, and whoever ends up being elected will deal with it. We'll have to figure out. We have three independent branches of government, and we've got states as well as the federal government, and we'll figure out what to do if that's what happens. But I can tell you I don't think that's a wise, prudent, or safe choice, and I'm going to be working very hard to have that not be the result in November.
I noticed that Merrick Garland, remember him? Appointed by President Obama to the Supreme Court, nominated to the Supreme Court, and a response which is, you know, basically, we're not going to do it, say the Republicans. What do you make of the fact that they have, I think I saw an article in the Times the other day, for the first time, done anything like that? What do you make of it?
Well, I am so outraged about what happened about this. That I actually introduced legislation to counteract it. I'm a member of the Supreme Court Bar. Many years ago, as a young lawyer, I had a Supreme Court practice. I've had the opportunity to know Merrick Garland for over 30 years now. He's an extraordinarily fine individual, a brilliant jurist, a thoughtful, careful judge with a big heart and a great mind. He'd be a tremendous asset on any bench. He is right now on the D.C. Court of Appeals, and he ought to be on the Supreme Court. And, you know, Orrin Hatch has spoken out in other nomination hearings in favor of Merrick Garland and extolled his virtues. So I'm going to continue to renew my calls on the Senate to bring up his name for consideration. And then they can vote as they will. They can vote as they will. It's the same way I feel about the American people deserving to see how their representatives vote on gun safety legislation, close the terror watch list loophole. All right, see how your member of Congress votes. But to deny votes means that the American people are denied a voice and the accountability for their members of Congress and what they're actually going to do. So the bill, the SCOTUS Act, which I introduced, the Senate Court Obligations Trump Unconstitutional Stalling Act of 2016, with a number of my colleagues from across the country, would require that the Senate and House stay in session, not recess for the latter part of July, which happens to coincide with the party conventions, but instead stay in session as long as it takes for the Senate to take up and take some action of some sort on Merrick Garland's nomination. Because in history, as you referenced, in history, the Senate has always acted. You know, they've acted in recent times, 100 years or so, they've acted within 125 days. They've taken action of some sort for a nomination that has been put and left before them. And they really ought to be taking action now. And frankly, I would have to think some of them are having serious heartburn now as they look at their own party's nominee, who they don't feel too confident of. If you look at Lindsey Graham's comments, for example, and Mark Kirk, both of whom are disavowing their support for Donald Trump, does suggest, do you really want to let, you're waiting until an election and maybe let this man name people to the court? Maybe that wasn't such a good idea after all, even as a tactic.
Elizabeth Esty, love talking to you. Think you're the best. And when we come back the next time, let's do a potpourri of things that you're interested in, okay?
Fantastic. Sounds good.